Good morning. A true believer from Utah says ending homelessness means starting with housing first. Former Utah coordinator on homelessness Lloyd Pendleton began with a pilot program for the years that he was there, and he says that through it, he brought chronic homelessness to functional zero. We'll talk with him in a few minutes. And later, HUD Senior Advisor for Housing and Services, Jennifer Ho, talks about what's at the nexus for the strategies to end homelessness. And to end our series, State Coordinator on Homelessness, Scott Morishige, gets the final word. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Students at the John A. Burns School of Medicine work at free clinics around Oahu. We'll talk with Program Director Dr. Jill Amore.
Coming up for this Friday, September 18th, that's The Conversation after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you this morning?
Well, we've got a lot of things on our plate this morning, but first we're going to shake things up a little bit, and we're going to talk about one of the issues that you've been following in terms of homelessness and how it's impacting our culture, and that has to do with the medical school, which is down there right in the middle of Kaka'ako and has been sort of at center stage with the Kaka'ako encampment out there and what impact that's having on students.
That's right. And as students and faculty learn every day, are reminded every day, a life without shelter is a life that's at risk of any number of medical conditions with minimal access to care. Students at the John A. Burns School of Medicine care for as many as they can through the school's Homeless Outreach and Medical Education Program. And the acronym says it all. These programs are quite literally close to home. Dr. Jill Amore is the director of the HOME program, and she's with us in our studio. Good morning, Jill. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
You know, when I first heard about this, I thought immediately of your Kaka'ako waterfront location, because this is a very visible problem if you work or study at the med school, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the students can't come to class every day without, you know, passing through all of the tents and seeing all of the people out there in the park.
So what was the impetus to get the program off the ground? You were in it at the beginning. It's now almost 10 years old.
And so in the beginning, I sort of felt that there wasn't enough education for medical students about caring for the homeless or the underserved in general. And so we really wanted to start a curriculum that would expose students to caring for this vulnerable population, and with the hopes that later in their careers, they would be more likely to want to come back and help this population, even if it was just volunteering time here and there. And at that time, there was a homeless population. It was smaller than it is now, but it was definitely growing quite fast at that time. And so we wanted to also meet the needs of the community and provide better access to care for these individuals. And so it was kind of a melding of those two problems that created Home Project.
Sure, because you guys are also kind of getting underway in your waterfront facility down there. So it's part of being a neighbor, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it would be socially irresponsible for the medical school to not do anything with this problem so close to home. And
sure,
it literally is our backyard or our neighbors. And, you know, we're in a profession that's supposed to be healing and serving the public. And I would feel horrible if we weren't doing something.
Well, when you talk about an underserved population, and of course there's way too many underserved people in this country and in the state, but There are medical problems specific to being underserved, right?
I think, you know, and that's another thing we wanted our students to be able to see, the differences in caring for these types of populations. So they definitely have different kinds of diseases in terms of more infectious diseases. We see a lot of wounds. We see a lot more complications of chronic disease than you might see in the general population. But also just the general approach to problems in this population, because they have problems that other people don't, in terms of other kind of social problems that lend to the diseases that they have. And so their immune systems are not good because of their malnutrition and just the chronic stress that's placed on their bodies, and having to be out, you know, fighting the environment all the time with the constant rain that we've been having.
Yeah.
That brings up a lot of problems. Constant exposure to the sun also brings up problems. And then I think, you know, it's easy if you are living in a home and have three meals a day and to make health your priority. But when you're worried about your safety and where are, you know, my kids going to be safe? Are they going to be able to eat? Then health becomes a very low priority for this population. And so learning how to provide good care with all of those barriers is something that we hope that our students are getting.
Also, I think most people who have, you know, access to medical care in the, you know, through work or whatever, have medical coverage, do a lot of maintenance that they don't necessarily think about. So, you know, you make sure your blood pressure is okay, mm-hmm. that you're getting, you know, your blood sugar, those kind of things that get checked when you have regular access to medical care can go unchecked for years in a homeless environment. Yeah,
I think, you know, the especially the silent diseases like hypertension and diabetes, mm-hmm. those are things that are going to definitely be ignored in this population, because if it's not an acute problem, they're not going to seek care for that or feel like they need to go check their blood pressure or mm-hmm. just get a general physical or things like that. And so it is usually the acute problems that will bring them in to see us. And so then we discover the chronic problems that are underneath that, and hopefully, you know, we can address those problems then. But it's usually the acute, you know, cold or wound on their leg or infection growing on their
sure.
back or something like that that brings them in. And then we would have to kind of dig a little deeper and try to provide them with the preventative care that we would in a regular office.
So it would almost seem as if care for the, as you described them, silent diseases was almost a luxury that they could not afford in
mm-hmm.
that environment. Well, that's, you know, that it kind of says that's frightening in terms of a society at risk, where a community could be so easily susceptible to an opportunistic infection of one kind or another.
Sure,
right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think there's so many factors that make it more easy for these patients to get a lot of infectious diseases, and then they don't get treated, and they're easily spread to other people because they're living in this crowded area, and they're malnourished, and they're not getting the care that they need. So it's just kind of it's a perfect storm for a lot of these diseases, actually.
Coming, no matter how good your intentions at a volunteer clinic to at least some of your clients, you're going to be, you know, authority with a capital A. You have that whole thing of you are representing an institution. You are saying, you know, wait here, come in, sit in this chair.
Mm-hmm.
Even little mild things like that to some people can represent a kind of an intrusive voice of authority. Have you seen any of that in your clinics?
Yeah, I think we have seen that, especially when we deal with the unsheltered population. I think there's a little more mistrust, and a lot of these people have actually had very bad experiences with the healthcare system. I think because when people see them, there's a lot of stereotyping that goes on, and I think they get treated badly a lot of times in healthcare settings. And so they also feel like we're going to report them if they're, like, say their child is sick, that, you know, we might report them to CPS and have their kids taken away, or we'll report them to other authorities. And so it did take
immigration authorities.
Yeah, immigration. So it did take some time to develop this trust, but I think by going out to their communities, we take our mobile van out there. And we're there every week, and so they get to know us. We establish relationships with the people out there. And so I think there definitely needs to be this trust building going on. And so for all the sites that we go to, you know, it does take some time, but I think over time they learn to trust us and they know that we're there to help them and not to kind of be secret spies for the government or something like that.
Because you can say as a medical practitioner that this is a confidential exchange.
Yes, yes. And even though we're a free clinic, all of those, you know, all of the confidentiality rules still stand. So,
well, I would think that the lessons go far beyond medicine to be taking part in this program. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Jill Amore is the director of the John A. Burns School of Medicine's Homeless Outreach and Medical Education Program. And you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
I've been traveling a while, haven't found a place to call my own. I've been a million miles, still feeling all alone. And I'm on my way back home again.
And this is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. And it's 8:15, and coming up, this morning's Backyard Quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're taking a look at a nonprofit organization that not only helps our state's homeless populations on a daily basis, but also serves the community at large during emergency situations. Founded in 1983, the Hawaii Food Bank is the only 501c3 nonprofit agency in the islands dedicated to collecting, warehousing, and distributing mass quantities of both perishable and non-perishable food. They do that to 200 member agencies, as well as food banks on the Big Island, Maui, and Kauai. Member agencies include homeless shelters and soup kitchens, food pantries, and various feeding programs, among others. Last year, the Hawaii Food Bank distributed over 12 million pounds of food, in addition to about 3 million pounds of fresh fruit and vegetables that were distributed through the food bank's Ohana Produce Program. As mentioned earlier, the organization not only serves Hawaii's homeless populations, but it also has stepped up to help the entire community during dire times. For example, in September 1992, Hurricane Iniki hit the island of Kauai with devastating force, and the Hawaii Food Bank responded by sending 1.5 million pounds of food to relief sites across Kauai. For today's quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us who founded the Hawaii Food Bank back in 1983. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for today's programming comes from Hawaii Theater Center. The new season opens with Fandango, a quartet playing a mix of Latin, Balkan, and classical sounds. 4 p.m. Sunday, September 27th. HawaiiTheater.com.
All the this week, we've talked with people from different communities around the country and some of the leading national voices working to end homelessness. While there's no singular solution that will work for all faces of homelessness, the nexus of all solutions seems to be housing, to which Jennifer Ho would add first. She is the Senior Advisor for Housing and Services to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, Development Secretary Julian Castro. A housing-first approach is the bedrock of all the strategies to end homelessness that her department is advancing. Jennifer Ho is now on the line with us. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Good to talk to you. Now, Hawaii seems to be on the track to meet that functional zero target for veteran homelessness. Chronic homelessness, not so much. Getting a semblance of reliable data on youth homelessness is tough. Even HUD acknowledges that youth homelessness is a hidden problem. And then there's that bedrock challenge of not enough low-income rentals for everyone in Hawaii who would need one, let alone the current homeless but working individuals and families whose homelessness is rooted in economics. So as you are now looking at Hawaii through the HUD lens, do you measure or how are you measuring Hawaii's progress in terms of the federal initiative Opening Doors?
Well, first of all, you have a great grasp of both the challenges and the solutions. I appreciate all of the homework you've done and all the coverage that you've provided this week.
Thank you.
You know, ultimately, the solution to homelessness is a long-term and effective affordable housing strategy. And, you know, that's something that takes commitment over time from all levels of government. We have some tools that we at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, can bring to the table to help finance affordable housing, but it really needs to be policy that's driven at the state level, at the city level, and you need to have developers and communities that value having homes for everyone. You know, what I have seen when I have been on Oahu is an incredible amount of development that has occurred. You know, the skyline is bigger than ever before, it seems, and yet there has not been a deliberate strategy to make sure that a certain percentage of all units that are developed are affordable to people with people who are working a minimum wage job or people who have fallen on hard times. And that's really where we need to see the policy shift happen, to have that long-term commitment. You can't put up housing overnight. You can't change the texture overnight, but it needs to be embedded in all of the development strategies that are happening across all the islands.
Looking at how that would be embedded also means there has to be an incentive to embed. What kind of incentive do you think needs to happen, given your deep knowledge of Hawaii and how it has been shifting and changing over the many years that you know Hawaii?
A couple of things seem really clear to me, that everybody who lives in Hawaii needs a place that they can afford to live. And what happens when people don't, sometimes it makes sense for families to double up and triple up and quadruple up. I've seen that with some of my own relatives. But we also just need an opportunity for people to be able to, you know, start a family and get a home of their own. But you talk about the incentives. I mean, nothing could be a bigger incentive to want to create more housing than the negative effects of what happens when there isn't a place that everybody can afford to live. And, I mean, you see that downtown. You see that, on the beaches. You see that in Chinatown. I mean, people need to confront the day-to-day reality of what happens with the homelessness problem when we avoid setting a policy direction to create more housing. And, the positive effects are really, that people who have jobs, people who are working, people who have disabilities, people who can't work, for them to be, members of a community as everybody is, and to be able to live alongside, their fellow neighbors, that true aloha spirit that is Hawaiian. And yet that has broken down. And I think that what happens when people walk past people who are experiencing homelessness every day is that our sense of family, our sense of community begins to break down as well. And in communities that have had a strong commitment to affordable housing development over time, you know, you have vibrant neighborhoods where, you know, people who are millionaires, you know, live alongside of people who are, you know, working in the working in the hotels. And it's, you know, we're all neighbors. It's possible to create communities where we can all live side by side.
Jennifer Ho, when you talk about those negative aspects that should be enough to be able to say we want a different vision, clearly, though, from everything you just described, we're not getting that here, because we do walk through all the areas and see the people who are out on the streets and all the luxury development happening simultaneously. Clearly, something more has to happen. Do you see something that's really missing from this equation that would drive a lot more affordable housing at the levels we're talking about, low-income rentals, that isn't happening now and a way to get there?
Well, first, I want to say that I really admire the political courage that the governor and the mayor, the steps that they've taken to be willing to say this is a problem that we need a solution to. And we need to work together, and we need to have everybody around the table in order to craft solutions that are going to work over the long term. So I am hopeful that with the governor's new task force and new leadership, commitment of some of his senior staff, but also the mayor and the governor working together, I don't know that that's ever happened in this way in Hawaii before. So I'm very hopeful that type of political leadership at all levels, supported by the federal government, is the beginning of a new strategy that has both a short-term and a long-term component. A part of that is going to mean that the state and the city need to take a look at all of the tools that they have for the creation of housing, and think about whether those tools are being as strategically focused on getting more affordable and supportive housing created at a magnitude that can reverse the trend and ultimately solve the problem there.
Okay.
And it really does require taking a look at mm-hmm. every single financing tool and figuring out how could we use this tool towards this long-term end. And that's going to require the legislature, that's going to require the city council. It's going to require everybody working together towards a long-term solution.
A couple of things from our discussions with all of Hawaii's mayors over this week. Housing First seems to have some real mixed buy-in, even with the Big Island's Mayor Billy Kanoi, who we talked with yesterday, who was full of goodwill for Housing First and said he supported it. But much of his narrative seemed to say that, you know, he has thoughts in other directions. Is Housing First really well understood in Hawaii by those who believe homelessness, and especially chronic homelessness, needs to have people in it who are, you know, housing ready before they get housed? So what would you tell them?
Yeah, I had an opportunity to meet with a lot of the providers on Oahu, at least when I was there, and then I did a phone call with some of the providers on the other islands after I got back last winter. And what I would say is that everybody has now gotten that's the federal direction. That's the policy that we're saying is game-changing. But I don't think that everybody has been willing to give it a serious try. And, you know, I think that a couple things. One is that all of the evidence on Housing First interventions is that it is incredibly successful at helping people, even who have been on the streets the longest, who have the most complexities in their lives, helping them not only stabilize in housing, but that housing becomes a platform for them making other improvements in their life. And there's just an overwhelming amount of evidence to that effect, which is why it is the centerpiece of the federal plan. But it means that providers need to really examine why they're doing the work and their mission. You know, if their primary mission is drug treatment and rehabilitation, not that everybody deserves a home, then it might be harder for them to make this shift to Housing First that says, you know, we need to get somebody in an apartment first, and then they have the space to be able to contemplate other changes in their lives. If that's not at the mission of an organization, that everybody deserves a home, then it's going to be a harder transition for them to make. I also think that what we've seen in communities across the country is that when a couple providers are willing to make the change, and I know that the state is funding a Housing First initiative that I think really has all the right elements to it, at least based on what I've heard, when a couple providers begin to embrace the change and do Housing First, there really is, it becomes harder and harder for people to deny how effective it is. Because what you will see is that individuals who maybe failed out of traditional treatment programs or failed out of traditional transitional housing programs or couldn't get in to those programs actually begin to succeed and flourish in homes with the right supports and make significant changes in their life. And when you see the results, it makes it harder to deny that that's a shift that has the ability to affect change. If everybody in Hawaii just keeps doing what they'll always do, then you're going to get the same result that you've seen there over the course of the last decade, that the problem just gets worse and worse, and the programs don't have the capacity to meet the needs of the people that you need to serve.
Jennifer Ho, in a moment we're going to have to leave you, but before we do, having just said all of that and also looking at the various pots of money that come into play, one of the HUD strategies is to, you know, fully engage and leverage mainstream housing assistance, reading from your website. That includes the Home Investment Partnerships Program and the Community Development Block Grants. Now, this week, there have been alerts from community agencies over the Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development Bill, which, among other things, funds those Community Development Block Grants and the Home Investment Partnership Programs. Are you concerned that now that it's with the Senate Committee on Appropriations, that that might get really sliced and really impact our ability to provide even more housing here?
Absolutely. The Home Investment Program is one of the best engines for the creation of affordable housing that we have, and communities love it because it's a tool that allows them to really fill the gaps when they're putting together the financing for the creation of affordable housing. What we're seeing in Congress is that both the House and the Senate have proposed really draconian cuts to those programs, and we know that that's a tool that, that you need. So I hope that folks are educating the congressional delegation. I've had an opportunity to meet with many of them, and I know that that they are strong supporters of the federal financing that, that's needed to help spur the creation of more affordable housing. You know, we also have the work that the public housing agencies are doing. You know, there are other parts. We have many tools in our toolkit to do this, but yes, it does all start with Congress giving us the appropriations that we need so that we can pass it along to you, so that folks in the community can create the housing that we need.
And the bottom line to this is really centering on the Housing First model, and it's everything that happens and flows from that, but it's really going to be a paradigm shift that I hear you saying that's going to be needed to make that happen and to be able to scale it with all the pots of money that might be available to do that. I wish we had more time. We'll talk to you more, I hope, in future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Jennifer Lamailiho is the Senior Advisor for Housing and Services to U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro. She manages the department's work to connect housing with health and social services and homelessness, define the housing needs of an aging America and individuals with disabilities. She shepherded the development of Opening Doors, the nation's first ever comprehensive federal plan to prevent and end homelessness.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Supply, announcing Radiance Reflective Roof Shingles, solar reflective shingles designed and made for Hawaii to reflect the heat and help keep homes cool. Learn more at RadianceRoof.com.
Alexander von Humboldt was an explorer, scientist, and the second most famous man in Europe after Napoleon. So why haven't you heard of him? I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, we'll rediscover a lost hero of science. Plus, we'll prep you for the International Observe the Moon Night, all on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
Once it was expected from a bride's family, and once tracking and displaying gifts was expected from state officials. But those days are long gone. Now there's a $200 cap on gifts, but even with the ethics rules regarding gift disclosure, city ethics rules that require those mandatory gifts disclosures every year, it's not the case for the city and county of Honolulu. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com. He has today's reality check. All right, Chad. It seems that the city is in a completely different bubble from all of this, and there's some real confusion over gifts.
Right. So the state requires an annual mandatory gift disclosure. It's up on the website of the State Ethics Commission. Nick Ruby, our reporter, opens up his story noting that Governor Ige, at the very top of our elected officials here in the state, he received, for example, a $450 Gucci toiletry bag. I don't know what he's going to do with that. He also received
That's what he's going to do.
That's what he's going to do, exactly. He won't use it himself. Another sailor pin, one of those fancy pins, for about $300. And it's all transparent. We can find out what they've received. It is because it's mandatory at the state level. It is not mandatory at the city and county level. So we don't know, unless they self-report it, what the mayor, Mayor Caldwell, and the city council members have to say in terms of receiving gifts. And that means we don't know whether someone was trying to influence somebody, some sort of interest, business before the council or the mayor, perhaps, to lobby, basically.
So this must be causing the Honolulu Ethics Commission a little consternation.
Well, the reason why this is so important and why the discrepancy, even the double standard, really is so important right now, so relevant, is think about Romy Cachola. He was one of several current and former council members. Cachola is now in the state legislature, who actually got caught because they did not report their gifts from lobbyists. Cachola actually ended up paying a $50,000 fine. And remember what he said. He said, "I'm not the only one. There's other people out there that aren't reporting this stuff either, and because of that, there is some serious talk that the rail votes, the $6 billion project, some of those votes may have to be retaken. That's something that Chair Ernie Martin has discussed. There's a lawsuit out there to that effect. So that's why mandatory gift disclosure at the city and county level might not actually be a bad idea.
But what takes it from being an idea to being reality? Is there a move afoot to do that?
Well, it actually existed in law back in 2002. Yeah, back in 2002, and Chuck Tato explained to our Nick Ruby that the reason why it was changed, it was just assumed that nobody would actually report a violation. They wouldn't actually say, whoops, here I am, caught. I am now going to disclose it here in this form. That's not the case. Instead, they went with the $200 cap. By the way, that's from a single source in a year. But having said that, remember, those gifts under $200 can also influence decisions that are made before the city and county. And so that's something that Chuck Tato is concerned about, these ill-gotten gifts and our lack of transparency for the public to find out more about this.
I mean, the point that you're making is that a gift, even if it's under $200, that may just be a token of a relationship, and it's the relationship that may be driving different decisions. And that's
Absolutely.
A little more difficult to quantify. Okay, we will quantify this by saying, have a good weekend. I'll talk to you on Monday.
You too. Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Straub Clinic and Hospital, Infinity of Honolulu, and Gourmet Events Hawaii.
As you know, on a Friday, we always take a look at what's coming out of our newsroom come Monday and throughout the week. And today, a familiar subject that we're going to talk about, that they're going to be working on next week also. homelessness.
Yeah, good morning, Beth Ann. You know, you and Chris and your production team have been doing such a great job all week highlighting some outside perspectives on homelessness, as well as talking with the mayors and others. Next week, a bit of a perspective also closer to home, the Grassroot Institute holding an interesting panel on the economics of homelessness and affordable housing. Now, again, that's pretty broad topic, pretty complex set of issues there, and a lot to cover. But Scott Morishige with you this morning is going to be part of that panel, along with Connie Mitchell of IHS, a whole number of other folks from different constituencies and presenting different perspectives. So, again, hoping to learn more on that and anything that helps move this conversation forward and helps illuminate and shine some of the challenges that are here, not just logistically, but also on the money end. Because if you don't deal with the money end, as we know, there's it's a much shorter conversation.
As we just heard from Jennifer Howard-Hudd, as we always like to say, the conversation on that continues. What else do we have that the news department's working on?
So here's something interesting. A group that helps some folks who need it most with technology. It's called the Assistive Technology Resource Centers of Hawaii. What they do is link people with technology in a way that helps those who are disabled. So in ways that people may not even realize, technology can help folks out who need it the most, who are disabled. And they put these things together. It's a educational approach, but it's also a very practical application. Various forms of technology, with people who may not even be aware that that exists. This afternoon on All Things Considered on HBR One, Dave Lawrence on the Helping Hands segment, Assistive Technology Resource Centers on the docket for this afternoon. And a bit of a musical preview, time for symphony season.
Uh-huh.
I would be remiss to not mention that. Noe Tanigawa steps back, not only a look at the first program out, also which includes a touch of tango, by the way, but a look at the broader season itself. So we'll have that and a lot more, too.
Looking forward to that. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HBR's news director.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Noheya Gallery and Kaiser Permanente.
In this morning's Backyard Quiz, we took a look at a nonprofit organization that not only provides services for the state's homeless populations, but also serves the community at large during emergencies. Created in 1983, the Hawaii Food Bank is the only 501c3 nonprofit in our islands that collects and distributes large quantities of both perishable and non-perishable food to a network of member agencies, as well as other food banks in the state. Included in its list of member organizations are homeless shelters and soup kitchens, food pantries, and various specialized feeding programs, such as the Food for Keiki Backpack Program. To give you an idea of how much food the organization handles, it reports distributing a total of 972,298 pounds of food in the month of August. For today's quiz, you're wondering if you can tell us the name of the man who founded the Hawaii Food Bank back in 1983, and the answer is John White at 8:45. That's today's quiz. And if you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, partnering with parents and educators in Hawaii to strengthen the connection between school and home with tools to help monitor students' gains. Achieve3000.com/HawaiiParents.
This last conversation will bring our series on homelessness from the outside in to an end. And to finish it, we wanted to give Scott Morshige the last word. As the new state coordinator on homelessness, not yet in his job a month, Scott Morshige's work as the former head of the advocacy group Focused is still very fresh. Now his work will continue to be informed by the advocacy of others as he and the governor's leadership team on homelessness shape policy. To wrap up the many themes that emerged during this week, Scott Morshige joins us now in our studio. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you again, Beltan.
As we heard throughout the week, from many different voices, community voices around the country, national voices, Housing First seems to be the real bedrock, and we keep using that term, bedrock, of how communities are either reinvigorating their push to end homelessness or have been able to do it. This morning we were to talk with Lloyd Pendleton, but we had a real problem with the line and we were not able to be able to speak with him. But Utah, in 10 years, set out to end homelessness. And he was not someone who originally believed in Homeless First, Housing First, until he saw what happened with the chronic homeless population that was used in the pilot project. Put 17 people into a project, and 22 months later, they were still there, which seemed to thwart the idea that you need to get people who are chronically homeless into a, you know, housing readiness mode before they sort of earn their way into housing. That all brings up the fact that maybe we're looking at a really deep paradigm shift that we haven't quite been able to affect yet. Is that how you see it?
Well, I think right now we're seeing the start of a big change in thinking among government, service providers, as well as other private funders about how we approach the issue of homelessness. And I think Housing First is proven to work. It's evidence-based. It's a best practice that's worked in other communities across the country, as well as here locally. We have right now a state Housing First program that's been very effective. Over the past year, we've housed 75 of the most chronically homeless individuals on the island of Oahu and placed them in permanent housing with 100% retention. Similarly, the city and county of Honolulu has a Housing First program that also has been very effective and has moved a number of individuals off the streets where they've been staying for a very long period of time into permanent residences of their own. So I think it's something that we're beginning to scale locally and also look at how can we incorporate a Housing First philosophy across all of our different types of housing resources.
So talk a little bit about that, because we've talked about the model and sort of what that means, but in terms of the philosophy as you see it, what is that?
That the goal in providing homeless services is to get individuals and families into permanent housing as quickly as you can. Shelter is not the end point, but it's a means to an end. There's still a role, I think, for our emergency and transitional shelter programs in a Housing First model. And what we're really trying to do is make sure that everybody across our system sees permanent housing as the ultimate goal, because I think that's really where we want to head.
The shelter idea being that is the stopgap moving someone into permanent housing. But we've had a lot of conversation around shelters. And when we've talked to the mayors this week, there seems to be a real wide range of understanding of what Housing First is, or even buy-in for Housing First. So how do you see a movement to align all of Hawaii's counties if this is going to be how the state is going to drive the end of homelessness forward?
Well, I think, you know, like I said, this is a pretty significant change in thinking. I think there's been a lot of positive steps. The very fact that, you know, the different mayors and other government officials are now referencing Housing First and also permanent supportive housing in the language, I think is a really good sign. What we're trying to do now is look at Housing First not just as a specific program, but again, this philosophy of how do we use all of the resources at our disposal, outreach, shelter, and so on, and incorporate Housing First throughout all of this. For example, in Kaka'ako, you know, what we're doing is we really started with a focus on data, looking at how many people are in the area, what are different levels of need. And what we saw from the data in Kaka'ako is that many of the individuals and families there are there due to economic factors. There's a very low income in the area. And for that reason, I think using shelters as interim housing or bridge housing on the path to permanent homes was something we felt was appropriate. And so we've been trying to link families in the area to shelter where they have a place to get necessary services, build their income up, and then we want to help move them from there as quickly as we can into permanent homes.
But for individuals and for homeless youth, et cetera, there are different strategies that have to come into play with that. And in some cases, even just getting the data. Last night on Town Square, we talked about how it's very tough to wrap your arms around the issue of youth homelessness because, in part, those counts are so low. They're so undercounted. And just even finding them. But yet, the service providers are you know, tracking how many people they're talking to and the relationships that they have to build to be able to help somebody transition into all of that. So getting the data that's accurate, plus the fact that you have lots of different pots of money involved with all of this. How do you see being able to streamline better data at the same time that hopefully you're able to streamline more pots of money into looking at how do we use this money in the most effective way and not just keep putting it into sweeps or paying law enforcement or doing all the other things that happen, fighting a lawsuit now for the city that seems to not come up with a really good endpoint that means the end of homelessness.
Well, I think the start of all of this is really having coordination and alignment across all of our different levels of government, city, state, and federal. And I think with the governor's leadership team on homelessness, and you look at the composition and who's on that team, we really are having the start of having coordination, not only among the people providing the direct programmatic services, but also among those who make the decisions about resource allocation.
Policy.
Yes, and I think that's really key. I think what we want to do as we move forward is also have alignment not only among our government resources, but also among contributions from the business and the philanthropic sector. And I think I've been listening to your interviews that you've been doing all week long, and I think in some of the other communities that have made significant strides, that's been really key, of having the alignment not only among the government resources at the table, but also among business, philanthropic, and the faith-based communities as well.
And that was a really big theme that we heard emerge from, Portland, from Houston, L.A., Seattle in some ways, although Seattle is particularly challenged because they started with Housing First, kind of let it go fallow, and then now they're trying to ramp it up again, and that caused them to, lose some ground on it. But all of these communities are saying you have to have buy-in across the board and bring together both the usual and unusual suspects. Are there unusual suspects, as Beth Sanders from Community Solutions keeps trying to tell us we need to have? Are those people here that you think that are just beginning to emerge now?
Well, I think that there are efforts going on underway right now. In the philanthropic community, for example, I know that the Hawaii Community Foundation has led a group of local funders to invest in an initiative to address the needs of homeless families, the Housing ASP initiative, which I think has made great strides so far. In addition, in the business sector, I know the Waikiki tourism industry has been supportive of a lot of the efforts with IHS and some other housing programs. And I think there's also been discussions recently with the faith-based community. So I think we're starting to have some of that initial dialogue. So I think we're moving in the right direction, definitely.
And before we say goodbye to you, is there a particular end to something that you see happening now? I mean, something that you want to have happen that's on your to-do list that you'd like to have us know about now as we look at the next 6 months to a year?
Well, I think definitely we're looking at all of our existing resources throughout the state as well as the city. I think trying to make sure that we maximize the efficiency of all those resources, as well as look at whenever we're even thinking about building up shelter, that we're not only looking at the temporary and the immediate, but any idea that we have for building shelter also has a plan for the long term. And ideally, how can we use temporary shelter space to possibly convert into permanent long-term affordable housing over a period of time?
I wish we had more time, as always, but we will in future. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks again.
Scott Murashige is the Hawaii State Coordinator on Homelessness.
Realize what we've been through. Roses do grow in our hearts. We can be so impatient, restless sometimes. Never will I stray from your good foundation, yes. Soon as we get stuck in hard days, we get up 2 days to rise.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, proud to help fund construction of the American Cancer Society's Hope Lodge in Hawaii, a place for Hawaii's cancer patients and their caregivers to stay. Learn more about Mattson's giving at Mattson.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Keith Richards tells us about creating his transformative guitar sound on songs like this one. Richards has a new solo album, his first in over 20 years. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
And that is the end of our homelessness series, looking at it from the outside in today. And we'll have more conversations about homelessness as we move through the coming weeks and months. It's not something that, as you heard Scott say, it's going to be ending quickly. But as we keep talking about it and seeing how these various different perspectives are aligning and how the state is now moving in what he thinks is a different direction, we'll see how that plays out.
I think we've heard some really valuable insights this week.
Well, I think that those insights that we keep hearing from other places who have done well or have been challenged and then realize that they've had to make real changes are helpful in hopefully making us be able to reach our challenge and meet the end of homelessness a little sooner than perhaps that we might have otherwise. As we've had all these conversations happening this week, especially over the last couple of days, we've also had our early bird campaign that's been in effect, and we want to thank all of you who have called up to this point. We know every call that calls that comes in helps us to bring the pledge drive in maybe a little sooner than it might otherwise do. We've had 306 early bird pledges, and we thank you so much, including those 22 brand new members. Want to thank Francis Shenen, Paige Ogata, and calling in from Kaneohe, Mimi Beams from Honolulu, and to Gay Arakaki from Mililani, and Theodore Nishijo calling us from Salt Lake. Thank you all for being among the new members of our family. If you'd like to hear any of the new of the shows that you missed in our series, tell them how to do that, Chris.
Well, you can get another past show or links to more information at the archive on our HPR website, hpr2.org. And our executive producer is you, Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Taylor Rice is our program assistant. And Caitlin Ikuma is our research assistant.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. And I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you Monday.